Termicide presents. Login.
I know you're going to dig this.
Hello and welcome to Login, the new podcast from Termisoft, University of Film Computing Society. With me today are Ben Ali.
Hello.
And Rich Jeffrey.
Hello.
And I'm Dan Kosser. Hello. We're just going to talk about some geeky stuff that's caught our attention recently. We're going to begin with what we've been loving and hating over the last week or so. So, Ben, what have you been loving and hating?
I have been loving Sisters of Mercy's album Floodlands, which, you know, it's 20 years old. I still like it. I have been hating bitmap fonts because the last few days I've spent hours and hours trying to get decent looking fonts on my Linux box, and it's rather irritating.
So you can't use this TrueType or something like that?
I can't find any decent TrueType fonts. There are decent bitmap fonts, but they're bitmap fonts, so therefore suck.
What about the... Doesn't GNOME have a big old standard for their fonts and things like that?
Yes, but none of those fonts are actually much good.
Fair enough.
I find the default GNOME fonts are very ugly.
You are right, though. To be honest, I don't know why anyone uses bitmap fonts anymore. It's just completely and utterly ridiculous.
They're fine if you only want to use them at a specific resolution.
Hmm.
I use bitmap font for my externals and whatnot because it's only ever going to be displayed at one size, and that size looks good, so it's fine. But, you know, for web pages, you do kind of want TrueType.
Cool. So, Rich, your loves and hates.
Right, at the moment, I'm loving Naughty Dog Giant's new album, The Elves, which has just come out on iTunes in America. Annoyingly, that's the thing, it's not available internationally, it's only available in the US store, which no one really understands why, but it is. But it's coming out on CD in July. When I talk, you keep looking away from me, because you probably think that I'm high on pot. But I'm not. Look me over, I'm the captain. You say it's such a joke, but
I've always thought that to be an absurdity, especially in the iTunes, you know, the whole music download, the internet, and the thing that they release things, you know, staggered release schedule. Surely there's no point anymore. It costs almost nothing to distribute music like this. There's no costs. There are costs, obviously, but there aren't as much as, for example, releasing a CD. So
you don't really have a per unit cost.
Exactly.
Well, I think it's probably something to do with some of the iTunes. This iTunes store is being owned by different sort of companies.
Yeah.
Because the iTunes store in America is like iTunes USA. There's iTunes Switzerland and so on and so forth. So if a band, because that would like release it themselves, give it to iTunes and say, here's the US copy, it's only going to get to the US store, it's not going to get to the other countries, which is just plain annoying. But it's still worth hunting down. Get yourself an American pass just to get it, or wait for July and buy the album from the shops. And the one I hate is loan adverts. It's just ridiculous when you watch television and you just find, like, back-to-back loans. Loans and loans and loans. Worst one is probably Picture the Loan.
Hi, Picture?
Yes?
I was calling about a loan.
Do you have a mortgage?
Yes, I do have a mortgage.
Where the shit is my breakfast?
Try the garage!
I've got a gun.
Nice.
I've got a gun.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna put it in my mouth. Oh,
cock.
Oh yeah, it's just like a cock.
Oh you.
Yes, there are some absolute classics out there, I'm sure you've seen. And myself, I've got a lot of loving at the moment. With the end of my exams, I've been getting all philosophical. I've been reading a lot about neo-Darwinism, all the, you know, Richard Dawkins and his call to arms for atheism and stuff like that. I've been looking into the scepticism and things behind it all and the arguments and things. I've been getting all, you know, argumentative. But, you know, me, I'm rubbish in a debate. And I've also recently been loving the, in the podcast theme, Penny Arcade, the webcomic, Tiger Ray and Gabe, whatever their real names are, I can't pronounce them. But their podcasts are amazing because they sit themselves down in a room for an entire hour with a laptop and a microphone switched on and they write their comic in front of you. And two of the most insightful guys into the games industry. It's always good to listen to them. Having a good matter.
I'm interested in it.
Yeah, I would definitely check out the free version for sure. I think it's got a cool look.
Yeah. But as far as breaking them down and just making the tiers ridiculous.
Yeah, the
come on.
The VIP shuttle is
funny. That's really funny, and they've given us an opportunity here, and it seems like we should take it.
I wonder what a VIP shuttle in that world looks like.
What, in the Gothic London?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I assume it's some kind of chariot.
Yeah. Stretch chariot.
Yeah, stretch chariot. But I think that free play members have to eat the heels out of a loaf of bread. Like, they have to eat the ends of the loaf.
I call that the butt of the bread.
The bread butt?
The bread butt.
To be honest, I'm not surprised you picked something that's in the realm of comics after seeing your 37 comic-a-day ritual.
I do love my webcomics. What's wrong with a little bit of comedy in everyone's life?
So what have you been hating aside from webcomics that don't update me regularly?
In the comics theme, Spider-Man 3. Now, I don't know if you've seen the movie, but if you haven't...
Yeah, we all have.
I've seen it twice. I really don't recommend you go watch it. It's terrible, terrible writing. I have seen reviews and things that have just called it lame or just, you know, not great. But personally, I think it is an absolute perfect study into the art of writing a bad screenplay. I mean, you can just... I could just remove big chunks of the movie and cut it down to half an hour and it'd be great. There's some fantastic special effects, but it's just... I've never seen such a horrible collection of badly written characters in one place at one time.
I'm going to ask MJ to marry me.
A man has to put his wife before himself. Can you do that, Peter?
Yeah, I think I can.
We have some new information. This is your uncle's actual killer. We lost his trail 2 days ago.
This man killed my uncle,
and he's still out there.
Everybody needs help sometimes, Peter. Even Spider-Man.
I did read somewhere that the screenwriter basically said, right, I've got two stories here. And basically, we've got quite a lot of movie here. We could separate out into two movies. But then they couldn't find a way of splitting them up. So they said, may as well keep them together. And that's why it feels like it suddenly shifts gear halfway through.
Yes. Well, the one I heard was that the director, Sam Raimi, wanted to do a movie about his favourite characters, the Sandman, played in the movie by Thomas Hayden Church, and he's one of the great actors in it, and the Vulture, and they breaking out of jail and their whole thing, whereas he was pushed on by the studio and stuff to do a movie about Venom, who is a big character in the Spider-Man world, but he wanted to do both, had to do them both and try to cram it all into one movie, and it really didn't come across. Venom and Eddie Brock, played by Topher Grace, really came across as an incredibly one-dimensional character, but tinged with bits of the Sandman, which there's hints of a great story, but it just did not materialise.
Absolutely. I still think it's totally ridiculous that they've killed off Venom in one movie. Brought him to life, moved it to a different character, killed him off. Yet, Venom's lasts, I don't know how many comics.
Oh, blooming ages. He is the antithesis of Peter Parker. He is the dark side of him. It's the core of half the blooming comics.
Well, to be fair, it's his Marvel, so they can resurrect him without any problems.
That's
whatsoever.
True.
That's true. There'll be another chunk that hits, the, you know, that lands and attaches himself to probably his new scooter.
No, that would be too obvious. So it would come back from the future or something, or possibly the past or another dimension.
Probably 1.21 gigawatts of power. Thus combining two movies. Oh, if only it was owned by Universal.
Yes, anyway, Spider-Man 3, don't watch it. Go and get yourself a copy of Spider-Man 2 or Spider-Man 1, both great movies in my opinion.
I don't know, actually, has anyone seen Spider-Man 2.1? Perhaps a new release with extended cuts.
Oh, blimey, guys, just not worth it. I get sicker when they keep re-releasing movies with an extra 30 seconds of footage. Wow.
Star Wars.
Call it American Pie. I look away, unseen. Oh, look, we've changed one thing. But we'll say, oh, it's got a whole extra sequence in it. 15
oh, yes.
seconds more?
Of course.
Anyway,
moving to the actual body of this cast, not just us ranting. Ben, now you have a couple of interesting stories. What would you like to start with?
Well, I'm going to start with one that generally gets the three of us into big rants, which is the GPL and the author of the GPL, the GNU General Public License, that is. In case you don't know, in which case are you living under a rock? I don't actually know how to pronounce his name. Eben Moglen?
Moglen?
Eben
Moglen, yes.
Yeah. Him. A Columbia University professor and whatnot.
Typical.
He has basically... Well, the idea for the GPL version 3 was, at least, that... it would require web services like, for example, Google or Yahoo to contribute any changes to free software that they made. Obviously, at the moment, GPL, if you modify a product and distribute it, then you have to distribute your modifications with the source and whatever. But if you're just allowing people to use it, for example, like Google is, you don't get to download Google. They were originally going to require you to distribute your changes in that case as well. But they've apparently decided not to do that.
Although Eben Moglen is encouraging companies to do that.
He has at, let's see, Open Source Business Conference in San Francisco Tuesday. He's encouraging people to do it. He says that community pressure and software licenses, not software licenses, will most likely drive Google's continued contributions to GPL projects.
But anyway.
So, what are your thoughts on this?
I think the main one is, yes, yay, distributing and sharing software and changes made and stuff like that, but Google, especially, which is the one that's been mentioned in this article, already do. I mean, I've got an article right here in front of me from end of April with Google and MySQL, and Google, I believe to be the largest MySQL user in the world, have been pushing more and more features into MySQL development, and more importantly, into mainstream MySQL, but not just specialist add-ons. Because MySQL have always been funny about other people adding patches, haven't they?
Or yeah.
They've recently given in to Google. And Google do a lot in the community, especially in web development with the release of their Google Development Toolkit and things like that, their web tools and things like that.
Well, if you look at their policy, they hire various free software developers. Guido van Rossum, who wrote Python, or the main author of Python, and Bram Molnar, who wrote Vim, to name but two. They hire them on the basis that they can use a third of their time.
20%, isn't it?
well, 20% of their actual paid work time to work on a free software project. Obviously, in these cases, Python and Vim. But I'm fairly certain they're not the only ones hired under this. So Google aren't exactly a fair target, because Google do a lot more than most companies anyway.
So what would you say as a company that would be a fair target? You're not allowed to use Microsoft yet.
Well, Microsoft don't really make use of any free software.
What about the FreeBSD things that keep occurring?
I don't know whether they certainly used to. Hotmail, before Microsoft bought it, was run on FreeBSD servers.
Mm. The whole thing a while back about the, when XP first came out, there was the big network hole, because they'd used,
Well, that's BSD license, isn't it?
True, and BSD
license. Which doesn't require you to give back the code.
True.
In fact, OpenBSD used the license for the very purpose of getting as many people to use it as possible, so that as many different companies as possible are using decent code rather than writing their own crap implementations of it. Sorry, that's probably unfair. AX is much worse.
So apart from Microsoft, is there any other companies that...
I can't think of any off the top of my head. But, to be fair, I'd suggest that any company that doesn't release source code for everything should do so, because they should.
Well, that's a bit of a risky... That's a bit risky, to be honest, because you're talking about... Okay, I know Hot Topic is DRM and good, and mentioning iTunes.
A few months ago, my candidate would have been Sun, but Sun have now released Java. Or are released.
Yeah. And of course OpenSolaris.
OpenSolaris, yes. Which I am actually waiting now to receive installation CDs for.
You should download it.
I could, but I couldn't be bothered.
So you've got to instead wait for it to come to you.
It's worth waiting for, not putting any effort in. It's not really worth
it. I know that there was sort of some study recently about how it was actually quicker to FedEx a trillion megabytes of information than it is to just send it over the internet.
They did that.
There's a terabyte. It was quicker to FedEx than it is to just transfer.
They needed to move around vast quantities of scientific data or something, measurements and all that. So they just put it on a hard drive, marked fragile, and posted it.
Yeah, it was the same thing with, I think Google do that as well.
Google do that.
Just to move things off of stuff by doing.
Yeah, I think it would be good if people relying on free software did make a contribution. Then obviously not required to most of the time.
Mm.
But I think they should do it because it's the right thing to do, not because they have to. Because if they just do it because they have to, it's going to be shit, basically.
Mm.
But I don't think Google is a fair target to complain about, because they are pretty good.
Yeah.
And apparently they are bumping up their contributions in the near future anyway.
To say, ha, in your face. I was about to say, in your face, beard face. I apologise.
Okay. Well, to be honest, Google's strategy for... In applications, I realise, of course, that their main money is advertising. But in applications, their entire business model relies on the average developer knocking out code and things for them.
Mm.
And closing off code and source code and stuff just makes no business sense. So even though it's not required of them, they're not exactly doing it out of their own free will. They're doing it in the same way that Microsoft releases vast quantities.
They're doing it because it benefits them to do so.
Exactly.
Rather than because they are required to by some license.
Yes.
Hmm.
That's a topic
where are we? 16 minutes.
I think we've ranted for a good 5-10 minutes about the GPL. I think that's quite enough.
Yeah.
We do rant about the GPL and free software quite a lot, the three of us, so it's probably going to come up in the future anyway.
Well, bearing in mind, we've got in front of us Debian laptop over there. We've got a Mac laptop and a Windows laptop. So
we're getting together with some hot Laptop loving.
Yes.
Oppo system loving. That's what I'm looking for.
Cross-system loving.
Cross-system loving.
That's important, that as well. Yeah. Anyway, moving swiftly on. Rich.
Hey, who should we network with? We'll have some Ooh, good baby. Times.
Yes, through your little pond. No, Rich.
Yes, actually, quick. Small plug. Buy a phone router. End plug.
Yeah, they're quite cool. It's a cute little thing. I thought it would be bigger.
Tiny.
Rich, what have you got for us this week?
Okay, this is direct from Dell. Dell offers free consumer systems with Ubuntu 7.04. This apparently is beginning 4 p.m. today. Well, this is 4 p.m. Central Time. Yeah. So yes, Dell are now shipping to the US free new systems with Ubuntu. Apparently a desktop, a notebook, and one of their XPS systems. Apparently the desktop and notebook will be $599, and the XPS system will be $849. As you know, Ubuntu being a Linux distribution, it's that's the first time a big company has done it.
And any Linux distribution, yeah.
Well, any Linux distribution to a mass audience. Because, of course, they can ship it without stuff.
They've always done it to servers and whatnot. Yeah. They have for years.
Well,
but not preloaded.
Not preloaded. They'd give you the installation disk and whatnot with it.
So. Mostly because they expect that if you don't know how to install Linux, you really, really shouldn't be touching it.
Well, yeah. Yes, that's very true.
But presumably now they consider Ubuntu to be usable enough by someone who's just going to go out and buy a computer.
And also, secondly, that there is the proper support for their computers, because that's the biggest thing, is that Ubuntu has to be properly supported and will work correctly with every system. And they have to train all their people to diagnose faults with Ubuntu, because any problem that occur, etc.
They're going to phone Dell, not Ubuntu.
Exactly. But what's people's opinions upon Ubuntu as a personal desktop system?
Now, personally, I'm on and off a user of Ubuntu. Now, I haven't used the latest distribution, Feisty Form, which is 7.04, which is the distribution Dell are offering, but I've heard good things. Now, I personally like it, because I am very much a graphical guy. I like my user interfaces, and I like things to be very, very easy. Now, this is in contrast to my counterpart over in the corner, Ben.
Dan and I can, as he pointed out a few weeks back, basically complete opposites technology-wise. I did try out a beta version of the latest Ubuntu release weeks back. I was kind of impressed in a I'm never ever going to use this kind of way, because it is amazingly easy. It just seems to work. My computer just works, thank you very much, anyway. I don't need some people.
I apologise if you hear giggling. It's just my girlfriend Christine has just walked through the door. We were holding a whiteboard saying, food is ready.
Yes, small price, that's quite good.
I'm not likely to ever use it, because I'm perfectly capable of setting up Debian to work exactly how I want it anyway, thank you very much.
That's very true,
on the other hand, I was impressed by the way it just worked.
Hmm. I'm actually currently running Ubuntu Feisty Form as a dual boot on my machine, because unfortunately I've got to stick with Windows XP for some stuff. And actually, I'm actually very impressed by the way it's jumped on leaps and bounds over its previous versions. I mean, it has got the proprietary sort of startup thing where it says, we cannot use open source ones, would you like to use these drivers for your hardware? And to be honest, I think it works quite well, but the problem is that I do not think it's actually the best desktop system out there. Because the thing is, I actually switched over to Ubuntu from SUSE after the whole SUSE problems with Novell going to Microsoft. I thought, well, maybe there's going to be some problems occurring between areas of Linux. I don't want to be stuck in a system that gets closed off. But I've tried Ubuntu, and to be honest, actually it's not as good as SUSE on a ease of use front.
I suspect maybe Ubuntu. SUSE is aimed more, slightly more at least, at a power user.
Mm.
Ubuntu is pitched fairly at the entry level user.
Actually, no, I think this is actually the opposite way around. I've had more problems. So more problems which required a bit of knowledge to fix in Ubuntu than I have done in SUSE. For SUSE, everything was, you could do mostly everything in X. You didn't have to go into the command line or bring up a terminal to fix things, because there was already a whole systems thing, a bit like a control panel in Windows, for just fixing everything, for setting up your servers and everything. And Ubuntu doesn't actually have that. It has some of the features, but it doesn't give you everything that's...
SUSE has Yast, doesn't it? Which is
it does have Yast.
On top, which is not kind of integrated so much. What Ubuntu seems to do is add things to GNOME to do what it wants. Whereas Yast is something separate. Which is maybe why.
Maybe, yes. Maybe it's because Ubuntu tries to get away with using stuff that's already in the community and just modifying it slightly for their own purposes. Unlike SUSE.
Or alternatively writing something and getting it
moved into GNOME. Rather than SUSE, which builds their own stuff for plugging on. But the problem is that then it removes it from the system.
It's something specifically for SUSE, not for GNOME.
But the thing is that what do people want? As a Windows alternative, I would always pick SUSE, because I just don't think Ubuntu is quite there yet. Give it I'll give it 6 months, maybe a year, for the next couple of versions to come along.
Given the rapid speed of development and the very, very well-defined roadmap that the Ubuntu team have, I don't think it's going to be long before we'll be in that situation where it will be.
I think another good thing about Dell supporting Ubuntu in future is that what now is stopping HP bringing out SUSE desktops, and so on. I mean, HP officially support Debian on servers, but don't sell it. If you phone up and say, I've got a server with Debian on it, and I have this problem, HP will not laugh in your face.
Well, you're just saying the precedent has now been set for regular boxes to be sold. And obviously Dell's market share is infinitely bigger in the home desktop market than, say, HP is. And also in the business market, Dell is king.
It basically took someone to be willing to make the jump and support it.
I think this is a big thing about Dell, though, is that they do make those jumps. Now, the IdeaStorm website, which is where the idea originally came from, is the site through which users can comment on Dell and suggest new features. And I think this is an indication of how people's opinion can change policy. Now, Dell has made a bit of a jump, because just because people say they want something doesn't mean they're actually going to go out and buy it, or they're going to use it, or whatever. So it is a bit of a risk for Dell, but I think it will be a good risk. I think it's worth it.
Well, yeah, it's very true. In fact, I would probably say that most people nowadays who use Windows are using Windows because either it came with their system already, or they're using it in the office, or basically they've grown accustomed to it. And I think that having a big shift into moving, basically trying to get people in front of Ubuntu machines in the office might bring people into using it at home, because that's what tends to happen.
One interesting aspect, of course, is that now Dell has brought Ubuntu into the realm of commercial use, as in being sold. What does that mean for the other big commercial Linux players, Red Hat and Novell being the obvious ones? Now, obviously, they primarily only sell the software. They're not hardware providers, but they are major commercial sellers of software. Now, if Dell is coming in and now they're selling the operating system and the hardware, what's that going to do to all the hard work that Red Hat and Novell do and their market share?
Yeah. That is a very good question. Maybe, you know, maybe you'll have, like, sort of Linux companies kind of moving into sort of having building hardware, as in having, like, hard sort of certified hardware that designed for the, a bit like Apple. And also, to bring this in, the new Amiga computer, which runs the latest Amiga OS.
Wow.
I would so love that. I would so love to get a nice Amiga desktop or laptop. You know, because also it's backwards compatible, but it also runs on, I don't know if it's a PowerPC or if it's Intel, I'll have to check that one out. But to be honest, that's a wandering off topic as usual.
I can't see Amiga OS quite taking off like the, say, iMac or something. Gotta be honest, but people like Rich, it's a blooming godsend, so.
I'm such a pessimist. So, Dan, what have you got?
Okay, well, this is not exactly a recent development, nor is it anything in the near future, but I just wanted to talk about Firefox 3, which is not slated for a final release until this November 2007.
Blimey, that close.
Well, they've been working on it for quite a while, and to be honest, this is the big Firefox release. Now, 2 and 1.5 were great, but essentially they were just... They were just...
Ben, hand signals don't really
sorry,
work.
I shouldn't gesture at Dan.
Ben did a kind of...
My point was guesser. That 2.... Well, Firefox 2 wasn't actually amazing at all, in my opinion, compared to 1.5.
But
my point
anyway,
was...
it's Firefox 3.
1.5 and 2 were simply additions to the existing code base, continuations and little features. There wasn't really that much added in Firefox 2 that was all revolutionary and exciting than the release of 1.5. I don't know if you agree, but in my experience, I rolled from 1.5 to 2 without even noticing that it had happened, really.
Apart from the new, annoying new tab.
The new tab things.
And the Google auto-search thing. I don't know whether that actually happens on... It doesn't happen on the Mac OS, but it happens on Windows.
Yeah,
where when you Google something, it auto-suggests...
Yes.
I believe that's Windows only. But anyway.
But at the end of the day, those are little things that can quite happily have been changed by an extension or whatever.
So what's 3 adding or doing this? So,
well, the big thing about Firefox 3 is, well, firstly, there is the release of Gecko 1.9, so they're bumping up to the new layout engine. And this is the bright and shiny new one, which should be more efficient, it should do prettier things, it's all of those wonderful little bugs that Firefox is good at, while of course still maintaining standards. However, the bit that's exciting for me personally is the introduction of the Police's storage engine. Now, this is intending to replace the incredibly old and incredibly broken storage engine that's used at the moment called Mork. Now, Mork is a really naff little database that currently stores all of your bookmarks and your history and your favourites, and all of this kind of thing is hidden away in these little binary blobs in Mork databases. Now, for a long time, it's been a real pain for developers and extension writers and users generally, because there is a the API for it is fairly rubbish, and Mork is a very inefficient and horrible storage format to do anything with. So, for Firefox 3, they have ripped it all out and replaced it with an engine that's based on the homegrown Moz Storage API, excuse me, and the well-known and respected SQLite database system, which you have has a wonderful SQL-based interface to it. Mm. Now, for Firefox 3, the idea is that it's all been ripped out, and so you will now be able to access your history, your bookmarks, and your favourites all through one single interface, one single intuitive interface. The idea being that modern extension developers and the core developers are going to have a much better way of bringing new features to the user. Now, on the face of it, your average user is probably not even going to notice, because these are back-end changes. But it's important that we will now be able to write decent extensions and decent new features. Now, with the rest of Firefox 3, there isn't all that much else. I mean, there is big developments in the use of Zool and the potential for Zool Runner. Mark Finkel in particular, he is one of the lead developers for Zool Runner, and there are big, with the release of the Zool Explorer, which is the new IDE for coding in it, there's a lot of potential there for rich internet applications, as you call them, based around the Firefox base, which could be considered to be competition with Silverlight and Apollo, the recent releases by Microsoft and Adobe. But Firefox 3 goes further than that and has support for things like Microsoft's Click Once and things like that. So they're expanding their base, and I think Firefox 3 will be a really core and important milestone in the history of Firefox, that Firefox 2 really wasn't. I don't know what your opinions on that are.
Well, I probably made my opinions on Firefox 2 clear at the time, which was that what it actually added over Firefox 1.5.
Well, I would say apart from sort of some sort of improvements to its back end a little, to try and make it a bit faster, because Firefox 2 is faster than Firefox 1, and also the new ISS system that they've incorporated into 2. There wasn't a lot that was too different, just new, was it new icons, etc.
My kind of opinion is, why was it Firefox 2? Why was it not just Firefox 1.6?
That is actually very true.
It's a very good point. As I said, a lot of the changes were superficial. Mm. Not bad, they were all good changes, but...
There was a slight change to the code base, though, I think. Because Firefox 1 ran on sort of 1.8 point something, and Firefox 2 ran what, a higher level of 1.8, but not
Gecko.
Yeah, so Gecko.
I first became involved in free software as a user, basically, around Firefox 0.8. That was the application that got
me. Yeah,
same with a lot of people.
Most definitely. I mean, we talked about 0.7, 0.8, that's when it really exploded.
That's when it really took off. And at the time, you know, 0.7 to 0.8, well, all of those early versions.
Well, six, back in the days, it was still called Firebird.
Well, yeah, even before that, I believe.
Back then it was Phoenix.
Those, you know, 6, Firefox 7, 8, 9, there was a lot of development going on. There were lots of changes between releases.
Mm.
Each different version made a difference. And since 0.8, certainly since 1.0, I feel it's kind of gone downhill. It's become more seemingly corporate driven.
Well, the biggest thing is that as it grew older, you got the memory leaks got so much worse, I feel. I feel that back when it was like 0.8 to 1, it felt fast, it felt fresh, it felt something. But Firefox 2, you kind of use it and you go, I don't really feel the advantage over it anymore. Especially as what IE7 has caught up.
Yes, and true. IE7 is a very competent browser. I personally don't get on with its new interface, but I don't get on with Office 2000's new interface. I think it was
2007.
Yes, sorry, with the ribbon system and things like that. Mm. That's just a personal thing. But Firefox, having spearheaded this change in browser technology and spearheaded this standards-driven development, it now needs to really keep going with this. It can't stagnate.
It was kind of originally sold as lightweight and fast and whatever.
And technically it is still lightweight and fast.
It is, but, you know, but it's not about lightweight.
Well, no, back when it first came out, it was a breath of fresh air. Well, you've got to admit it. It was leaps ahead of other browsers.
Leaps ahead of IE6, certainly.
IE6?
Leaps ahead of, I don't know what any of the browsers were like at the time. To be honest, I don't know what many of the browsers are like right now.
Actually, I can't, to be honest, I apologise, I'm rolling off topic again. I still can't believe the University of Perth is still using IE6. I suppose it's partly down to the fact that they're using that piece of rubbish for a portal.
Yes, which will all change this summer. Did you see the sign?
But the switching of the SharePoint. Exactly. And actually, I've spoken to some TechNet people, including some people who are TechNet developers on my course, and they've said that they don't understand why they're switching over. They're switching to SharePoint. Because SharePoint isn't what they need.
No, and it's a horrible piece of software. I've used it before, and it's kind of Microsoft's attempt to make a community-based portal.
Yeah.
Piece of software. But it basically comes across as a glorified media wiki that has been kicked in the balls. It really doesn't have the back end that you really need to be able to do anything important with it. I mean, I've only used it briefly as a developer.
I've never used it.
I don't think anyone's going to. It just seems a bit ironic. We only had the new portal, mm-hmm. what, a couple of years ago?
Well, it's been there since I've been there. So we're talking about, I think it was introduced 4 years ago when they put out new computers.
Yes.
Because new computers were brand new when we first came along.
Mm. God, we're old.
Yeah. We are old, we're really old.
Yes.
And look on the bright side, you've just finished.
Yes, I'm about to graduate.
And poor Ben, he's still a youngster in everyone's eyes.
Well, with any luck, next year I'll be a second year, finally.
Yay!
Cue happy dancing, certainly
anyway,
from me.
Back to Firefox. Well, that's why IE7. I mean, it's a very good point about IE7 and why hasn't it really been deployed across businesses. And the businesses I've worked with, none of them, even now, have rolled out IE7 or anything like that, because there's no trust in it. Mm. And there's not because of any previous experience or anything like that, it's just they're used to IE6, they know how to secure IE6, and they don't want to introduce new software.
Well, it's the same thing with Vista, to be honest. The reason, basically, quite a lot of companies are holding back, including the university's holding back for a year upon Vista, and that's because it's untrusted. People don't know whether it's going to work properly or not, they don't know whether it's going to have huge bugs in it. And well, I can't remember which company it was Dell or HP, who said, after switching all computers over to Vista, they've said, we're going to now roll out.
Wasn't it?
It's Dell. Yes. We're now going to start rolling out XP machines because people are wanting them.
Yes, they are specifically asking for XP.
All of us, you know, support non-techie users at various times. And, you know, I've seen people, when faced with IE7, because it's upgraded them, it's brand new, completely confused because they've moved everything about. I have looked at some thought, what's it doing? Why is everything moved? Why has it gone from the kind of traditional toolbar, icon bar with the URL thing next to it? I'm having a thing with words at the moment. Why has it gone from that design of every single Windows application, certainly up until this point? Why have they changed that?
Well, look, I think it's probably because they're trying to move away from the whole old system. The whole thing of having menus. They're trying to make it a bit more free flowing. But I can't remember who I was speaking to a few people about people switching over to IE7 because when it first came out, I was saying, to be honest, I don't think people are going to like it. People are going to see IE7 and go, sort of not comprehend what's happened. They think they've broken a computer or something. But apparently, people who use Office, who use like more the recent Office ones, like Office 2000 and Office 2003, they seem to understand it because things like the star is favourites, but it's also a similar scheme to Office. And people are kind of getting along with it. People who use it in the Office environment are kind of seeing how it's flowing. And to be honest, 2007, despite it being completely different, after about half an hour of usage, you really see the difference. You really feel that it's a lot better program. Because Word 2003, it's ridiculous. It's full. It's absolutely full of crap. It's just piled on, and it's just so unbelievably slow.
Whenever I use Office 2003, or even 2002, XP, I think, well, what have I gained with this piece of software over 2000?
Alright, well, that's the comment I made to Skip before 2007 was released. I was discussing it with Skippy and asking exactly what had been added even since Word 97, if not Word XP. And, well, I won't say he couldn't name anything because he could, but actually I'm fairly certain that he was wrong that that had been added since Word XP because I'd used it before that point.
Which was?
I cannot remember off the top of my head what the feature was that he claimed had been added in 2003.
That's great. I've got a feature for
footnotes, I believe.
Footnotes have been around since...
Word 97
definitely had... I'm pretty certain Word 97 had footnotes.
Well, I certainly used them in...
I'm pretty certain that Word 2 had footnotes. I apologise. Word 2 was my first experience of Word because it got passed down to me from generation to generation.
Is this Word 2 for Windows? Or
Word 2 for Windows. We're talking like...
Not quite that old.
So we're talking, what, 90... I think it came out like 94, 95. It was Windows 3.1 based.
Yeah.
It was back when they were still fighting with Lotus Notes and Word Perfect and all of them.
But I do recall footnotes being there. And ironically, I never actually found a reason to upgrade from Word 2. And then I went from sort of Word... to OpenOffice. I didn't really have a phase where I went into other Office products.
Well, there's another product that I could argue about for hours upon end. It's no secret that I don't actually get on with OpenOffice particularly well. It's a personal thing. I don't particularly like the interface and I find it very slow. I think it's a product that could really do with a new refreshing release. They could do with an OpenOffice 3, whether that's coming anytime soon or not, I don't know. But, I mean, Firefox was almost falling into the same trap as OpenOffice, where they were becoming very stagnated in their feature set and just kind of, like, improving it. And that's what I think the Firefox 2 release was about. It was just, you know, making these little changes. Whereas Firefox 3 is actually pulling the thumb out and making some significant changes across the board.
I mean, I can't really comment because I don't use Office products of any kind. Really, unless I need to convert something from one format into a format that I actually am willing to deal with. So, I don't know, but I don't know, again, what was added between 1.5 and 2. I know they changed the user interface to something completely horrifically ugly.
But that doesn't... Oh, what, are you talking about OpenOffice there?
Yeah, OpenOffice, yeah.
It is horribly ugly.
Coincidentally, they did the same with Firefox from 1.5 to 2.
But the thing about Firefox is that if you don't like the interface...
You can change it.
Very, very easy to change. We've got three people here using three different copies of Firefox, and each of our interfaces look completely blue and different.
Yeah.
And I think that's the great power of Firefox, and it is the single feature that has stopped me going to another browser. It's simply because I can get a copy of Firefox and beat it with a stick.
Well, exactly. I'd love something much lighter than Firefox. But the problem is, I would not be able to find something lighter than Firefox with exactly the feature set that I have from Firefox, plus my very specific set of extensions.
I think a lot of that is from the Mozilla Foundation's, in my opinion, groundbreaking idea of making... really thinking about the developer and making an interface that is easy to use and writing the actual user interface in a language that's very easy to change. Zool. I think Zool is one of the best things about Firefox. As a language, it's a bit dodgy, but the simple fact that the interface is blindingly easy to change, you get such idiots writing extensions that can change things. And the level needed to be able to go in and write an extension for Firefox is incredibly
basically low. You need to know a bit of XML and a bit of JavaScript. Ooh. And you can do things. And you may not be able to do interesting things.
Well, no, that's not even true. You can do some pretty nifty stuff. Now, I did a module only last term, which only used Zool and it only used basic JavaScript, and it was better than MS Paint. It was amazing. And I believe you're doing...
That's very true. I did see yours.
It was a fantastic piece of kit. And you know, Zool Explorer, the IDE for programming Zool, is completely written in Zool and basic JavaScript. And it's an amazing piece of kit. I like it. And to be honest, at the end of the day, the Firefox interface and the Thunderbird interface and all the other stupid little variants of it, they're all written using the same interface language, and it's a damn fine piece of kit. Whatever you say about it, it is the adaptability, I think, is the greatest and best strength.
And ironically, it's Microsoft who go on about how they care so much about developers.
Okay, Ben, now after that wonderful rant, what else have we got?
I am going to rant about the One Laptop Per Child project, or rather the fact that Intel appears to have developed its own low-cost PC initiative. If you don't know, the One Laptop Per Child project is trying to develop a $100 laptop so that, in theory, every child in the entire world can have a computer, which is a fairly good idea. It's open source development and whatnot being put to the benefit of actual people all over the place rather than just geeks. And Intel are apparently designing their own laptop in competition with, well, not, you know, competition exactly, but an alternative to it, which obviously is going to detract attention from a project that I'd say needs support.
I think Intel were in the running to help out the One Laptop Per Child, but the problem with the whole scheme was they couldn't see the point of developing a specific operating system that was completely different to any other operating system available on the market.
Well, it's not. It's Linux, but it's got a different...
It's got a different front end.
It's a different...
Yes, it is Linux, but it's the... Essentially, for most people, the GUI makes the operating system. Well, the way you interact with it makes what it is.
Well, that's fair enough. The user interface of the officially called the XO, apparently, it's quite unusual. It's basically designed to be as intuitive as possible because, you know, they're going to be giving out hundreds of these, and they're not going to really be able to spend much time teaching the kids how to use it. Mm. It's going to have to be as obvious as possible. So, you know, something like GNOME or KDE isn't going to be particularly useful for that.
Well, just chuck my weight in. I mean, this isn't particularly relevant to the story itself, but I personally have never seen the advantage of the One Laptop Per Child project. Now, I can kind of see it, and it's all well and good getting computing to the masses, but these are, from what I've seen in terms of their target market, when I say market, obviously not trying to sell, but these are people who, yes, computing is great, but at the end of the day, that money, that $100 per laptop, could be being put towards much better things. I've never personally seen an argument for the computer over, say, money towards a better school.
Mm. Yeah, but surely the computers would be,
I think,
for a better school.
Yes, essentially the project is designed not for as a replacement for schools or anything like that.
Oh, obviously.
It's designed as basically once you've got a school and once you've sorted problems out and sort of the part of the world you're in, the laptops are the next step up. They basically allow the students to get on the computer. But actually, I was going to switch back to this whole Intel thing, where the reason why Intel dropped out was, of course, that it wasn't using something like Windows, something that's a known, a popular operating system. Because the problem is that having this completely different front end means that you learn how to use this computer, and then you move on to what they call a proper computer, that was speech marks for anyone who is listening, they would have to relearn it all over again, rather than having something that's a bit akin to working on a full-blown desktop of any sort. I mean, it's completely different to Mac OS, the Windows, completely different to KDE or GNOME. It's different.
I think the issue is that they just couldn't. Well, I believe they can run Windows on it, but it requires a hardware upgrade that will bring it above what it is. Apparently, at the moment, it's $175, and they want to bring it down.
That is it a little can bit. Run, to be honest, that's a little bit ball honky, really.
Well, they've got to be fairly minimalistic on what they put there. You can't run a full operating system on the extremely limited hardware.
Yeah, but you could run something like XP Embedded. You could run something like Windows CE or whatever.
Well, one of the points of the project is you can, if you want to, run any operating system that you can port to that hardware. Mm. It's AMD chips, I assume it's x86 architecture, so you can quite easily port Windows on it to it.
I suppose, yeah. But it doesn't, you have to spend more money to get that.
Yeah, because it won't fit onto the base hardware. You'd have to add, I think you need extra flash to fit the entire thing on.
Mm.
AMD apparently tried their own project to do similar to one laptop per child, similar to what Intel are doing. And apparently that has helped, that has now brought, because the project failed, that has brought them into the one laptop per child project, and they're providing chips for that. I don't see why Intel couldn't contribute to the project, maybe providing an alternative interface for it, which could be done a lot. It doesn't need a competing product.
Well, what's wrong with a competing product? At the end of the day, if this means that there are going to be more computers being sent to these schools, does it matter that there are going to be two competing brands?
Well, admittedly, it means that then the two possible systems might not interact with each other.
Well, thinking about that, the thing is, will Intel's platform have, A, all the features of the One Laptop per Child project? Will it be free software and free hardware? Or will it just be another locked-in proprietary product?
To be honest, knowing Intel, because of their general ties, it might well be sort of Windows-based. Admittedly, you know, Intel being in Macs, you know, it might not be so much of a case, but I can imagine that Microsoft are going to make a pledge for Intel's products.
Yeah.
They're going to say, we're going to put Windows in there.
Well, because Microsoft got sort of snubbed a few weeks back.
Yeah.
By being told that no, it wasn't. They weren't going to put Windows on, at least by default, although you can quite happily run any operating system, as I said a minute ago. It's just a case of fitting it onto the hardware. I believe they said that saying no, you can't use Microsoft would be exactly the same as saying no, you can't use Linux.
Mm.
The point is to have a free platform. I am actually quite interested in some of the advances made by the project, but I won't go into that right now because we're sort of running short on time.
Mm. Well, to be honest, I think this is an area where it will sort itself out within a matter of months, and it will either reveal to itself to be an amazing, a good thing to have these multiple platforms, or one of them will disappear.
Mm.
Alternatively, we'll be sitting here this time next year talking about how it's all been a complete fiasco and it's descended into madness. Unfortunately, it's could be able to be too early to tell, despite the fact that the OLTC has been going on for ages.
Yeah, we're talking year and a half?
If not more, yes.
Well, I mean, in the public limelight.
Yes, that's true.
Well, that's my point. It's been around this long. Why
has Intel suddenly gone, oh, we've got a product for this? Why don't they actually lend a hand on the OLTC thing?
If they don't like the choices made by OLPC project, why don't they get involved and, like I said, provide an alternative interface for it?
To quote the BBC article from which we got this, I think, which is a pretty good answer, This is actually a quote of a Professor Negroponte, who was the one of the main forerunners of the OLPC project. Intel and AMD fight viciously, he told CBS. We're just sort of caught in the middle. And I think that really sums up what's happened here.
Because AMD are supporting it, Intel can't go anywhere near this.
Exactly. And it could lead for bad things for the RPC, but it could be we'll find out.
Personally, I prefer AMD to Intel anyway.
Well, to be honest, it doesn't really make any difference to me. Yeah. I don't want to sort of go into a big debate about this, but to be honest, Intel and AMD are just keep jumping over themselves, and there really isn't a market winner in my opinion. Anyway.
Right, so, Rich, what's your next topic of discussion?
Well, my next topic of discussion is harping back to what I keep constantly ranting about, mostly because I have one of their laptops in front of me, is a greener Apple. Essentially, for the past year or so, Oxfam has sort of generally been in complaint with Apple, because despite them saying, oh, it's quite nice that you're trying to help out with environmental recycling your computers in the US and so on and so forth, but in other countries, you throw them on the heap, and they're full of stuff that's particularly bad for the environment, like lead and cadmium and so on and so forth. And mercury, and also things like PVC, because PVC doesn't really biodegrade.
If I remember correctly, there was a study on it, weren't Apple the worst for environmentally friendly?
Well, I don't think they were the worst.
They certainly weren't very good.
The problem is that it's much easier to scapegoat Apple because Apple are the only people who make those machines.
Well, yeah.
The thing is that if you said, right, all PC manufacturers, you'd have a much larger percentage.
That's fair enough.
But anyway, so basically Oxfam have been complaining for quite some time about using all these nasty chemicals and so on and so forth. And essentially, Apple has pledged to start moving the stuff that's been listed as really bad. Like, for example, removing CRTs from all their product lines. You can now no longer buy an Apple CRT monitor.
Well, that's...
As of mid-2006. Anyway, because the CRTs are where most of the lead comes from, it cuts it out completely.
Well, I think this whole story is, as you say, Apple's been made of a bit of a scapegoat. I think Steve Jobs has rather risen to the occasion. But it's really a constant trend across the industry at the moment that there's finally some recognition that these machines that we love so dearly do really nasty things to the environment and to the people who have to live around the waste. Now, over the past, week or so, Staples America... revealed that they are going to implement a massive, this is US only, but a massive scheme for recycling computers, where they will take hardware from anybody, sold by anyone, whatever, and they will take in stuff, Staples, and via a third party, they will recycle it safely, all for free. And this 2007 could really be the year of recycling computers, and I think it's a good thing, something that geeks like us should really be recognising.
Mm. I mean, my girlfriend is very big on the environmentally friendly aspects of everything, so I'm sure she'd be quite happy to see that more computers are being made and as environmentally friendly as possible, because it's pretty... They're probably a major... I mean, they get used every day, and they're full of not particularly nice things. Just reading over Rich's shoulder here, arsenic and mercury in TFT displays.
Because that's in the backlights, essentially, because the backlights fluorescent tubing has got a small amount of mercury in. That's one of the biggest complaints, because, of course, the more LCDs you pile up, the more mercury you've got. And essentially, this is a combination of things, Apple does plan to replace their fluorescent tubing that they put in their LCDs with LEDs. I don't know. I think other companies are apparently doing this, but also companies are slowly surely moving on to things like OLEDs, the organic LED ones, instead of using LCDs.
Yeah.
So, you know, Apple are getting ahead of the game by saying we're going to switch over to LED backlighting, but eventually this is going to sort of phase out as LCDs become move on.
Similar to the Dell issue earlier, I hope it's something that Apple making a stand like this and saying we're going to get rid of this, everything that's listed, whatever. It will hopefully spur more manufacturers into doing the same. And you mentioned OLEDs earlier. And recently I've been somewhat interested in low power computers rather than environmentally friendly in terms of pollutants.
Yeah.
And as I say, OLEDs are fantastic in that regard because they basically only use power when they change.
Yeah.
Rather than all the time. So I don't know if that includes
think it's not quite the same thing because OLEDs are basically tiny LEDs. Basically if you replace every pixel on the screen with an LED, that's what you can't do.
Yeah.
So essentially they're self-illuminating. They don't have a backlight. They illuminate themselves. You're thinking of I think OLEDs do have that feature where they use less power when they don't change.
Yeah.
But there is another one which is like stuff they're using in like the paper displays, which essentially once they've changed, they stay changed.
Yeah.
They don't take any power whatsoever because their power is only sucked in when it's being altered. Admittedly, you look on the Apple website and they have got the Arduino Apple logo, and their commentary is very much a little bit of a rant because after they were found that it's a particular environmental group, they don't actually list which one it was, that Dell, HP and Lenovo all scored higher because of their plans, or plans for releasing plans in the case of HP, of to be more environmentally friendly. But they say that Apple is now ahead of all those companies by removing PVC from all their packaging, which HP have only just started incorporating, removing BFRs, which are brominated flame retardants, from all the casing, reducing the amount of PVC they're using in their casing. And basically Apple intends to basically clear out all the nearly all the waste, the stuff that cannot be recycled, by the end of 2008. And hopefully we'll see that there's some...
Well, it can't fail to be a good thing, frankly. The more manufacturers make environmentally friendly hardware, the more pressure there will be on the ones that don't to do the same. And
it's interesting to know that Apple is not the only company to be making big environmental changes. With the server farms and things like this, they have massive, massive power requirements, and they're being cut down through the use of low power servers and things like that. Dell announced last month or so that they're changing a lot of their packaging, so people who buy, say, 4 or 5 servers at a time, and up to 10 blade servers, I think, which is, you know, not particularly common with people like us, but, you know, big companies running big server farms and ordering...
Right, we can dream.
Yeah, we can dream. But they're cutting down on their packages by building big cardboard boxes that essentially double as pallets. And things like this. And it's little things like that that really work to cut down on waste and cut down on problems. And I think hopefully it'll move into the consumer, as in back to people like us, fairly soon, like Apple is doing.
So, right. So, Dan, what have you got for us then?
Right, well, this is to finish off, really. It's slightly lighter-hearted little segment. Basically, I am annoyed with the downfall of society in general.
How we all?
Yes. Well, nothing specific, but I was... basically, I saw this news article on the Register not so long ago, where a student has been expelled from a Texas high school for building a Counter-Strike map of his local school. And I believe his parents noticed this and went, ah, ah! And he was promptly expelled for being some kind of terrorist or something. And I think this is absolutely absurd. Now, myself, personally, I've created umpteen maps of local places.
Oh, yeah. When I was in sixth form, I started developing a map of my sort of sixth form in my school for use in an FPS. But not for the ability to shoot up all our students, but purely because it was a bit of fun.
Well, exactly. It's a local place that you know really, really well, and you're able to spot the things. And you know, it's familiarity. It's not, I'm not going to plan the best way to assassinate my little friends. But,
well, the thing is that what would be the fun in, take me into sort of the latest, being a bit morbid, the Virginia Tech massacres and the Columbine massacre and so on and so forth. Essentially, FPSs, you kill somebody, they come back to life. What's the fun? If you're the kind of person who likes killing people, what's the fun of killing the same person over and over again?
Yes, I mean, at the end of the day, we're looking at this kind of thing, and of course, there have been many horrifying accounts of guns in schools, and particularly the Virginia Tech massacre. But this isn't anything like that. This is blowing a simple hobby out of proportion into something that's physically quite dangerous.
Mm.
In a similar item of news, now if any of you follow webcomics, a man named Matt Boyd, along with Ian McConville, they used to do the amazing Matt Cool comic, which was one of my favourites, and recently they've restarted by doing a comic called Three Panel Soul, and it's an amazing comic in a really kind of odd way. Now, recently, and this would have been not long after the Virginia Tech massacre, he did a storyline where the lead character, who happens to look vaguely like Matt Boyd, was idly talking about purchasing a gun. And in the comic, someone in the next cubicle overhears him talking about the gun in just a glib way. And now, however appropriate that may have been, or whether he was actually doing it, he was never going to go out and violently murder anybody.
Mm.
Yet his boss managed to find this site and looked it through and thought, oh, my goodness, what's going on here? And he was subsequently fired from his job.
So it's now illegal to write about bad things happening. No author can ever write about any bad things happening in case they actually go out and do it in real life.
Even more bitterly ironic is that he lost his job over a comic, which is basically, it was basically being a parody, which was taking something out of context, and basically people mishearing stuff. And it's exactly the same thing. The guy being fired for something that's blatantly not relevant.
Now, admittedly, the timing may have been a bit off. Doing a comic storyline about purchasing a gun straight after such a horrifying story, maybe that was a bit off. But at the same time, this blowing it out of proportion like that is just insane. And he was completely blindsided by it. And it's quite clear from the interviews he did with Fleen not long afterwards and other news sites. Just totally unexpected.
He was fired for writing about buying a gun.
I encourage you all to
film. It was not they're making fun of buying a gun, but it's actually if you look at it, it references sort of what he could do with this gun, essentially.
Writing about doing bad things doesn't mean. Writing fiction about doing bad things does not mean you're going to do bad things. J.R.R. Tolkien never, invades...
I bet he wants to.
But that's not the point. He never actually did it. I'm sure, even if he could guess an army of orcs, he wouldn't have actually done it. He may have invaded Oxford, but,
Anyway, I encourage you to check out the site, because, of course, the site, and he probably needs your support anyway, but, I encourage you to read through the comic itself and see if you're offended by it. And I will almost guarantee
you won't be. I'm just finding out which when it was where he got caught for. I think it's number 22. No, sure that. No, 22 is where it's right. Okay, it's number 21, where basically he says,
"You be the other guy, and I'll be shall I be Matt?"
Yeah.
Okay. Fine.
Hey, Matt, you buy that gun yet?
No, but I decided on a .22 bolt action. I just want to do target shooting, and it's much more accurate than a semi-auto. And with the .22, it's hard to kill someone on purpose with that round. You practically have to put it in someone's face and pull the trigger, and even then, fire a few more times just to make sure the job is done.
And basically, there's a woman sitting in another cubicle, completely shocked. And basically, at that point, he got fired. And so basically, looking after. Basically, he goes to the next panel, to the next page, and he's being fired. Exactly. It's kind of, it's like life imitating art.
Anyway,
in fact, life imitating a parody.
Life imitating a parody of, yeah. Anyway.
It was a psychotic episode in the conscious of the world, in my opinion. And going back to psychotic nut jobs. If you're a gamer, odds are on you've come across a bloke named Jack Thompson.
Oh, yes.
Now, this man is a grade A ass. Now, he kind of came to public attention. I mean, he's been around for a long time, but he came to public attention late last year when he challenged the gaming community to produce a game that, among other criteria, didn't involve violent murder and things like this. And he said if they did it, he would give, what was it, something like $10,000 or something stupid, wasn't it, to charity. The gaming modding community, in their way, obviously rose to the occasion and said, okay, here it is. And Jack Thompson said, oh, I was only doing it as a metaphor or something.
Yeah.
At which the internet exploded. The Penny Arcade guys, who I mentioned earlier, they in particular rebelled against this. And in an act of, solidarity, they actually paid the money. They gave such and such amount of pounds, dollars, or whatever it was, to the charity that Jack Thompson originally mentioned. Through this, Jack Thompson went nuts, and it actually ended up almost as a lawsuit.
Suing Penny Arcade?
For harassment, I believe it was.
Donating to charity?
Exactly. It was basically thrown straight out of court. But
admittedly, I think at the same time, there was the campaign for Flowers for Jack. Which is basically gamers giving a dollar or two to this charity, which would then give a flower for each dollar that was submitted, and then send it to Jack's office. To be honest, he got the flowers. I think he shredded them and then sent them to Take-Two, the makers of Grand Theft Auto.
Yes, Take-Two being a company Jack Thompson really, really loves.
Ironic is Take-Two are a distributor of many games, including things like Civilization 4 and I'm trying to think of other games. Basically, plenty of Take-Two games.
Hundreds of
them. Yeah. And yes, Jack Thompson going up, basically went after Rockstar. Rockstar, isn't it?
Rockstar with the developers. Yeah,
Rockstar developers. Because Grand Theft Auto is incredibly violent. But only violent in the sense of if you do it,
yes,
it will happen. To be honest, you can play Grand Theft Auto without committing a single crime. Admittedly, it'd be very dull.
And it's quite difficult.
It'd be quite difficult. But it's fully possible to play that game without instant thought, with instant thoughts in your head. Mm.
Basically, it was a load of rubbish, and Jack Thompson seems to just enjoy causing trouble.
I believe I remember you blogging about this a few years back. I don't know how long back it was. But it was quite surprising, all the bile you directed at this time. It's normally mild-mannered business geek. Directing so much venom at some guy I'd never even heard of at the time.
Well, I think the thing about it is that I'm not normally an angry person. I rant a lot, but this man who was making, to be honest, a stupid, but, an understandable argument about games are bad.
Yeah.
And, but then he managed to, one thing or another, managed to take it out on a charity.
Yeah.
And then completely blew off this entire community who was trying to help him understand and prove him wrong. It was.
And the problem is that he, Jack Thompson does quite often make up stuff for the benefit of showing his cause, which is ban violent video games. Actually, to be honest, I understand partly where he's coming from, because in the UK, just in case you don't live in the UK and you happen to be hearing this, shock, you encounter things which are the ratings. I can't remember what it's called here,
The MPAA?
No, not the MPAA, that's it's the...
ASRD.
They're PEGIs now. They used to be. They're now PEGI codes. They are, the ISFE.
Lovely.
I can't what they used to be called, the ESPA or something like that. Mm. But anyway, I've completely forgot what they're called. But in the UK and in Europe, you have age ratings on games, not licensed like the BBFC's film ratings, which are 12, 15, 18, but basically ratings for violence and sort of, you know, the usual kind of stuff that people might complain about. But in the US, it doesn't seem to happen. It doesn't really happen. You know, you've got the I think it is the ESRA ratings in there, the ESRB, which is the rated T for teen. And so on and so on.
Exactly, and M for mature. Which is
for mature. But most shops didn't bother doing anything about them. They weren't classified as age restrictions. They were age ratings, but they weren't restrictions. And unfortunately, due to various things about freedom of speech and the...
Constitution
and so on and so forth. They people just jump up and go, no, every time something has been brought up about preventing kids from buying things. It's just the case. And I can see where Jack Thompson comes along regarding that, but he does explode, he basically keeps making up stuff and basically trying to weed all his way through this banning video game violence completely.
In the reason we're talking about this at all, I mean, he's obviously a bit of a prat. I suppose talking about him at all will only encourage him. But not, 2 days ago, he sent a rather entertaining letter to Bill Gates regarding Halo 3. Mm. And how it is obviously going to destroy young people's minds and so on and so forth.
You know, a game set in a fantasy world. There's not even real life. No. Such guns couldn't ever exist.
No, it's now he's recently been the Game Almighty argument calls it barred from suing Take Two after they had an agreement. Whenever it was,
it's like the legal equivalent of a restraining order.
Yes,
basically they're not allowed. Basically, he's not allowed to sue ever again.
Exactly, he's come up against Microsoft. And I'm not entirely sure what he hopes to achieve. Basically, the entire world has given up on him as any kind of reasoned and critical thinker.
Well, to be honest, many news corporations companies were on his side for a period of time until they realised that he was talking complete piffle.
Yeah.
And they've all disowned him, essentially.
But he continues wandering around the internet. Yes, I'm sorry, I'm speaking into my glass. But, basically, this is a public service announcement more than anything. If you see Jack Thompson walking down the road, then cross the other side in case you get infected by his aura or something like that.
Alternatively, give him a cuddle and tell him you play Vice City.
Yes, he needs the love, I'm sure. Anyway, that that happy and cheerful note, we will need to start wrapping this up.
Yeah. Actually, there was one final thing on the general agenda, which is, what are you drinking? Now, at the time when we started this whole proceedings, we were drinking something very, very British. You know, Dig Nation has their lager, their beer, their so on and so forth. We have tea.
Yes.
And our current tea of choice this week is the Sainsbury's Red Label.
Oh, yes, a very run-of-the-mill standard brand. Very nice, and it's certainly my tea of choice recently.
It's a very good tea.
Right. We intend to sort of try out various teas through the period of this lovely podcast of sorts. and hopefully we can give you a better sort of better understanding of the T spectrum.
And on that very eccentric note, it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
And we'll see you next time. Oh, did I say goodbye? I didn't say goodbye. That was you.
Oh.
Yes, maybe.
Huh? I didn't say goodbye from me, so goodbye from me as well as that.
Awesome. Right. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.
All right.
Bye.
Oh, nah.